Okay, well, thank you very much. And I'd like to thank Jim and the other organizers for the invitation to this, this great meeting. I've learned an awful lot already so far. So I'm going to be talking about black hole variability and a couple of different attempts to understand aspects of it. A lot of the work I'm presenting is being done by Drew Hogg, who's back there. So if there are any difficult questions there for Drew. So this is the quick outline of what I'll do. There's two broad topics I'm going to be talking about. One is the structure of the rapid aperiodic noise in black hole systems, and we'll talk about the propagating fluctuation model. And I want to sort of bring, you know, the title of this meeting is what, disks, dynamos, and data. I actually want to actually bring dynamos front and center into this discussion. And then I'm going to switch topics and talk about aspects of state transitions and black hole states, and this paradigm work under where there's a transition from a spatial transition from a thin disk to a thick rate of an efficient accretion flow, and some first attempts that Drew and I have been doing to look at the structure of those kind of disks. So the overall goal here is to use variability as a probe of some of the fundamental disk physics by connecting them with some sort of simple toy models. Okay, so let's talk about the rapid aperiodic variability. So this is an AGN session. So let me show you a picture of an AGN light curve. This is our famous 1H0707 that Chris was talking about earlier. And of course, you often see AGN, especially in the optical and UV, you often see AGN on a magnitude scale. And the light curve looks nice and symmetric. Remember, magnitudes are the logarithm of the flux. So if you actually put them on a real flux scale, it's not a Gaussian process. It's actually a flary process. It's a log normal process. And this is just a very simple histogram of exactly these data. You can already see there's a long tail on the distribution. So these are flary light curves, as you can see here. And if you go to systems where you can get nice long data trains, so this is Cygnus X1 in the hard state, then you can get these beautiful log normal, this is like one of those CMB spectrum type plots where you have, you know, the black body with a perfect curve going through it.
So I should be impressed. It's like if you had a Gaussian, it would be very little information in there, right? It's just
not. It's a piece of data. I'm not trying to impress with it, but yeah, it's just a piece of data. Yeah, and it's not clear why the observed variability should be multiplied. It should add, shouldn't it? So, but anyway, it's one aspect of the data. Connected to this is the RMS flux relationship, that the brighter the source is, the more variable it is. Now, these are all single band aspects of the variability. If you now take a light curve or take your data and you look at different bands, so in the X-rays, you look at different energies, then you find there's actually interesting connections between the bands. And this is, this dates back to the late 90s and the early 2000s. So you find, for example, that if you compute the coherence function, which mathematically is this, where the tildes are Fourier transforms, but physically what it's telling you is you take your light curve in a band here, you take your light curve in a band here, what fraction of those bands are connected with a simple linear transfer function? It's telling you that piece of information. And you do that as a function of Fourier frequency. You find that across a broad range of Fourier frequencies, they're highly correlated. And then at some frequency, you tend to drop off and they become decorrelated. And at some low frequency, they're also decorrelated. So that's one piece of information. And then you also find there are time lags between these bands. And the time lags are also a function of frequencies. So at different Fourier frequencies, you have different time lags. And this is a time lag plot from Yuri Batanin. And you can see that as a function of frequency, these two different, comparing, for example, the 4 to 6 kV and the 2 to 4 kV, you find there's a time lag there. If you compare instead the 8 to 14 kV with the 2 to 4 kV, there's a different time lag there. And a couple of things notice here is one is that the sense in which these time lags goes has this general form. If you compare different energy bands, so that the time lag goes to the logarithm of the ratio of the energies, which is exactly what you would get if it was just Compton upscattering time lags. Okay? But you look at the actual magnitude of the time lags, And you know, 10 to the minus 2 seconds may seem like a short time, but in the life of a black hole, that's actually not. You know, that's hundreds of light crossing times of the horizon. It's you know, many, many dynamical times in a disk. So that's actually quite a long time for two signals that you think are coming from quite down, quite close down to the black hole, to actually be time delayed. So the time lags are quite long. It is the it's the phase shift of the Fourier components divided by the.
What does that mean if they're not coherent?
It's the coherent bit. Yeah. So. Yeah. This time lag ceases to be defined once you can't. Once it's not coherent. Yeah. That's a good point. Thank you. So, just to wake up the non-black hole people, it is not black. Just black holes do this. I mean, everything does this, and this gets to, of course, to Mark's point that it's a very generic phenomenon. White dwarfs do this. So this is some nice. And there's been some nice papers by Skrinji et al. Who have unpacked this for all different kinds of sources. But white dwarfs do this. They have RMS flux relationships. They have log normal light curves. They show these are tiny plots. But basically, they show the same flux-dependent, frequency-dependent time lags and structures. Daniel, this is one of the anti-dwarf nova. One of the systems that's locked into outburst and occasionally shuts off. Sorry,
Nova-like.
Thank you. Yes.
But it's also present.
Yeah. And it's present in the burst state of dwarf nova. Okay, so as many of you know, the basic picture for this is the propagating fluctuations model. And the foundation of this is fairly simple. This was laid out by Lebarsky some time ago, which is that you have stochastic variability in the angular momentum transport mechanism, so in your alpha, and that makes a lot of sense if alpha comes from MRI turbulence. You have stochastic variability in your effective alpha, and that will, at some local patch of the disk, stochastically modulate the mass accretion rate. And then you have that modulating at every different radius with increasing characteristic frequencies to go in. And so you'll have sort of propagations of M dots coming in being modulated by progressively faster timescales. So what that means is that the outer parts of the disk will imprint long timescales on the light curve. Then you sort of pass that M dot in, and then you modulate faster timescales and even faster timescales. You end up with a light curve that has a large range of timescales imprinted on it. And Lebarsky originally proposed this, actually just as a limited exercise, to explain the power spectra of these objects. He wasn't trying to explain these other issues, it's just the power spectra of the objects. So just to look at that in a little bit more detail, Lebarsky actually linearized the problem. He took the disk equations and linearized them. Linearizing it actually gets rid of all that interesting behavior I just told you about. You can get the power spectrum with it, but you actually get rid of all the multiplicative behavior of the problem. And the rest of it was all basically on fill up these intuition that this should work. So quite recently, a couple of years ago, Phil Copperwaith, an undergraduate, and I just thought, well, we'll take simple disk equations and just integrate this through with the stochastic angular momentum transport term. And this was sort of born out of a bee in the bonnet I had about the fact that I didn't like the idea of these propagating fluctuations, because this is not a wave equation, this is a diffusion equation. Okay, what does it mean to have propagations in this equation? It's actually just sort of an asymmetric diffusion that goes on. So I was a little bit concerned about whether this multiplicative business actually would happen, because you don't have propagations going in. As it happens, I was wrong. It's just fine. But you learn some interesting things from this exercise. So you take the simple canonical disk evolution equation. This is the combination of mass conservation and momentum conservation, and then you just treat the viscosity as a stochastic parameter. So we just basically did some fiducial viscosity plus a piece that has a damped random walk to it. The damped random walk has some, we just used a Gaussian white noise process, and then some characteristic driving frequency. So that's important. It's got characteristic driving frequency. And to sort of summarize out what we found, if the fluctuations or the characteristic driving frequency of the fluctuations is slow enough, then all this works. You recover log normal light curves, RMS flux relationships, coherence, everything is just fine. And in fact, in the original Lebowski picture, he assumed that the fluctuations in the alpha, the effective alpha, were on the viscous timescale. So that all works. However, if the fluctuations are too fast, for example, dynamical timescale fluctuations, it actually doesn't work. And again, it actually makes a lot of sense that you have something that's varying very quickly in your disk. You know that very rapid fluctuations will damp out very easily as they're going through this. So in fact, you don't get any of this nonlinear behavior in the light curve if the fluctuations are too fast. And just to sort of highlight that, this is the case of slow driving. This is a sectional light curve. You get a slightly log normal light curve. You get RMS flux relationship, and that's the power spectrum. And the sign of that is you can compute the coherence of two different radii, and you do that, and you find that, so this is radius, it's actually radius to the power 1/2, don't ask why, and this is frequency, and you find that you are coherent between two radii if on time scales less than the viscous time scale. Okay, all makes complete sense. If you drive it too quickly, that coherence goes away, and the whole thing's incoherent. Okay. So here comes the puzzle, is that if alpha is fluctuating because this is MRI turbulence, you expect the characteristic driving frequency of the alpha fluctuations to be the dynamical timescale, wouldn't you? Because that's the timescale in which the characteristic timescale is the turbulence. So why does this actually work? So let's actually just look at this. So here's where Drew enters the picture. And Drew constructed a high-resolution MHD simulation of a thin accretion disk, HRR 0.1, and we ran it on the Maryland cluster. So in many ways, this is a fairly vanilla simulation. It's high resolution. We have 30 zones per scale height, even for such a thin disk, and we have to maintain resolution out in radius. It's a high-resolution run. The key thing here is you have to run it a very long time to actually get this temporal behavior. So we ran it a total of 2,000 orbits as measured at the ISCO. You just have to crunch this thing for a very long time. And lo and behold, this is the M dot at the ISCO. You can see by eye it's log normal. See by eye it's flary. Nice, beautiful log normal, RMS flux relationship. You have a power spectrum that is just as it should be. You may think, well, M dot at the ISCO is not what you actually see. That may be, for example, that may be indicative of what the X-ray flux would be like. But what we actually see is some emission integrated over the disk. Maybe that destroys this problem, or destroys this nonlinear variability. So if you actually have some luminosity proxy that we paint onto the disk, we find it's also log normal, so that's integrating over the disk. And so it does work. And of course, Chris would tell me, and I'll have something to say, that this is far too variable for such a thin disk system, okay, for real thin disk systems, for, let's say, galactic. But there's a nice break. Okay. And then let's look at coherence, and again, it does what you expect. So the red stuff here is coherence. This is radius and frequency. I'm taking my reference radius against which I'm computing the coherence as the ISCO at 6, and then this is meaning that radius is incoherent at that frequency, and the red is coherent, and the dashed line here is 1 over the inflow time scale as measured at that and that frequency. So you can see that again, roughly this works, that you have these coherence where you expect it. So why does this work? Because you'd have thought this would be driving too quickly. So let's look at the power spectrum of the alpha, of the effective magnetic alpha, or the magnetic stress, at some different radii in the disk. And you find that this mush here is basically the turbulence. But there's a strong spike in the power spectrum at a comparatively slow frequency, 10^-3. And it's not quite the viscous scale, but it's not clear. So where does that come from? So let's look at the time averaged B phi, and you find there's a very strong spike in B phi. What we are seeing here is a dynamo. We're seeing the dynamo cycles. Okay? And it's the dynamo cycles that are driving the fluctuations in the alpha slowly, comparatively slowly, that is driving the propagating fluctuations. And just to show you a butterfly diagram, that's the dynamo that we're seeing. This is the BRB phi stress, so you can see that, it's noisy, but you can actually start to match up patterns here, so that there's a butterfly sort of hidden deep into that in that mush. And this is 15, 20, 25 RG. You see the dynamo slowing down as you go further out. So this actually seems to work quite nicely. So to wrap up this first part, so take home message and some WAGs. That's wild ass guesses. So that's NASA speak for any budget estimates that come out of Baltimore. It seems to me that it's the dynamo cycles that drives nonlinear variability. Okay. Now, what would Chris say? Chris would say, but high-state black hole candidates, which should be those thin disks that we've been modeling, have very little high-frequency variability at all. So how do you actually match that? So now remember, the thermodynamics that went into our simulation was completely trivial. So first you have to worry about things like, well, there's a photosphere, so there'll be some diffusion that goes on. There's that kind of thing, but I doubt that's going to get rid of all of this variability. But if dynamo cycles are the key, that means that variability, the global variability of the disk, is fragile to those being killed. We've already seen in this meeting that there are various ways of attacking the dynamo. So this is the WAG. Maybe the dynamo process is suppressed in the high soft state due to thermodynamics. I mean, for example, Steve Balbus has talked about this Prandtl number instability. Maybe that gives you something that looks a little bit like convection that can come in and suppress the dynamo. We've already heard about net magnetic flux suppressing the dynamo. So these are all kind of, for future work, if you can attack the dynamo in the physical state where you expect the high soft state to be, then that could have profound implications for variability. And it could mean that basically you're limited to this very high frequency local variability due to the turbulence, but once you integrate over the whole disk, it all washes out. So that is what I wanted to say about the aperiodic variability. So let's now talk about state transitions in the last 12 minutes. So for those who don't know and breathe and live state transitions, this is a gorgeous representation of Cygnus X1 that Victoria Grinberg put together recently. Look at this top plot. This is the soft, quotes, because it's RXTE, soft X-ray flux from Cygnus X1. And you see there's these well-defined states. For example, the blue is this low state, it's when it's low, it's a fairly hard X-ray spectrum. And then occasionally you transition into these high states, these red states here. And when you transition to the red states, it gets, in this band, it gets high, it gets soft. This is the photon index, so it gets soft. And interestingly, the variability crashes down. So these are the flux, these are the state transitions. And Cygnus X1 has these approximately two states, the low hard state and the high soft state, and it basically flip-flops between them, maintaining more or less actually a similar luminosity. Now, there's the picture for this is let me just come back to here and say, another class of source that I'll talk about in a second are black hole transients that start off very low and they rise and then they undergo these transitions and then they come back down. I'll talk about that in a second. Now the basic picture for this is that the accretion flow geometry is different between the low hard state and the high soft state. So in the low state, and this is a plot from an old paper by Anne Essin, who really was the first one to write this down in a very beautiful way. In the low state, you have a geometrically thin accretion disk that goes, you know, a long way out, goes further than here. But then there's a disruption, there's a transition, there's a truncation of that cold, relatively efficient disk into a hot advective flow, into a hot, relatively inefficient flow. And then as m dot increases, the idea is that basically that hot flow is crushed or it goes away, whatever description or whatever. And once you get to the high states, basically you have a nice, thin, relatively efficient, we often sometimes say Sakura Sunny F, and though we probably don't really mean that, disk going all the way in, and everything is quite simple. And most pictures of these states are in this kind of idea, just to sort of, you know, and one other little twist that's been put in, for example, by this paper by Meyer Hoffmeister, is sometimes people talk about little disks inside of these hot disks, and the motivation for this is observational, because sometimes in the more luminous hard states, you know, when you're kind of getting up towards here, you sometimes see broad ion lines, which implies that there is actually some cold material in a thin disk that's very close to the black hole. So that's motivated some people to put little disks, mini disks, inside these hot disks. This is all phenomenological, though. And now another aspect of this, which is very curious, is the existence of hysteresis. So this is really for those black hole transients I was talking about. So this diagram, which we've seen a couple of times before this meeting, on this axis is spectral, is the X-ray luminosity. So fundamentally, increased M dot goes up here. And on the X-axis is the spectral hardness. It tells you which of these states you're in. So hard state here, soft state here. And the black hole transient will start off in quiescence, you know, somewhere down here, and will climb up. And it climbs up this branch, and then it stays hard to quite a high luminosity. And then it makes the transition over to soft. And then it can jiggle around, it can actually do loops here. There's something called the jet line. When it does this transition from right to left, there's often a powerful jet ejection events that go on. When it transitions from left to right, there aren't. Okay. And then as you decline, in your overall outburst, you stay in the soft state until quite a relatively low luminosity, and then you transition back and fall down. So there's a hysteresis there. It seems that the behavior on the way up is different than the behavior on the way down. And I personally find it profoundly confusing, because if you look at the time scales involved here, you know, this typical transition radius that basically is defining what spectral state you're in is thought to be 100 RG or so. Okay, so let's look at the time scales at 100 RG. Dynamical time scale is 50 milliseconds, you know, if you're talking about a 10 solar mass black hole. The thermal time scale of the disk, just taking it out of Sakura Sunny F, would be, you know, half a second. Viscous time scale depends upon how thick the disk is, but maybe 50, maybe you could push it to 500, but not much more than that. So the time scales are tiny. The time scales to come up and go around this loop and come back down can be weeks, okay? Maybe even months, sometimes months. So there's somehow the system has to preserve a memory of where it is and what its behavior has been over timescales that are vastly longer than any of the characteristic timescales you can think of in the disk. Jeremy?
Is that viscous time scale computed for the hot flow or the interacts with the cold flow?
That is, I think basically I just assumed H over R 0.1 and went from the thermal for that. So that was for the cold flow. Yeah, and I say depending if you had a lower mass accretion rate with a thinner disk, then that would go up a bit. You could push it up an order of magnitude, but it's still very far separated from the timescale of the overall burst. Yeah. So somehow you have to preserve that memory, and there's many papers out there for how you do this, and I'm not going to really tackle this. But one thing I do want to say is, for example, in many of these works, so for example, there's a paper by Mitch Beagleman and Phil Armitage, they actually attach particular importance to this transition region, that this transition region where you transition from a thin to a thick flow, they argue can actually be a source of net flux. It can be a place where a field loop gets opened up and there can be differential diffusion. You have essentially net field piling up in the hot flow but diffusing out in the cold flow. And this can give you effectively quite a high alpha in that. Thank you. Give you effectively quite a high alpha in this disk. And this place where you undergo the collapse of the hot flow is a function of alpha, actually alpha squared. So if you have a high alpha here, you collapse to a thin disk, you lose all your flux because it diffuses out, question mark, maybe we've heard talks at this meeting which would put that into question. You then your alpha drops, then you come back. But you have to understand this transition here. So this brings us to the questions that Drew and I were looking at, which is the need to understand the structure of these truncated disks. If to understand anything about state transitions, we've got to understand the structure of these flows. So, for example, can disks do this? I mean, this looks like an artificial, when I draw pictures of it, this looks artificial. I mean, a thin disk coming in, boom, it goes to a thick disk. What does this actually look like? Can you have a transition that occurs over a small range of delta R? Is a steady flow structure actually possible? Can you conserve all your quantities through that transition? If you can, what are actually the nature of the stresses? So what we decided to do was to, rather than taking a very complex code and trying to do the real problem, is make a toy system with an unphysical but well-defined cooling function that we can paint onto it that is just designed to drive a thermal instability at some radius, and then we can study the structure of the disk that results. So I'm not going to go into the details of the cooling function, but let me just show you the result of the cooling function. So we've designed the cooling function that is a true cooling function. It's always cooling, and it's balancing the heating, the viscous heating or the turbulent heating of the disk. And in some equilibrium, it has a particular H over R, and what we design is a system which in some outer region has an H over R of 0.1, in the inner region has an H over R of 0.4, and there's an overlap region where it can actually have either H over R, thank you, and then we let it go. So before we burnt a million CPU hours to do the MHD, we wanted to do the axis metric hydro alpha problem first. So this is what we have. So we initially set up a simple, constant H over R disk, and then we flick a switch and we turn on this bistable cooling function, and you can see the structures that develop. This is tuned for that radius. The innermost radius where there can be a cold disk is here. It's 10. It's 100 RG. It's here. And so the system you set up is indeed, you find that the cold, thin disk forms a truncation radius, and you have a thermal instability that sets in and in this region. And you have this limit cycle that starts, this quasi-periodic limit cycle that starts. We have cold gas sort of dripping off into the region. You also can see that you drive an outflow. There's a nice thermal breeze. I won't call it a wind because it's actually quite slow. There's a thermal breeze that's blown off this disk. So just to quickly put these up, this is the fraction of cold versus hot gas. You can see there's a real honest goodness transition there. This is the surface density plot. There really is a depression in surface density. There is actually a hole in this disk. And this is the radial velocity. You can see that but at least along some intermediate range of angles, there really is a nice thermal breeze that comes out, and then there's an inflow from the density floor. Okay, so we then went and burnt how many CPU hours? Two million?
Yeah.
2 million? Yeah, about 2 million. More than we would like to. Let's skip over this. And to do the MHD problem. And despite the fact we burnt so many CPU hours, I can't get the movie not to jerk. But this is the result. So this is the same system. Thank you. And again, we started off with a thin disk, and now we turned on the cooling. Of course, you have to do MHD in 3D, or else the whole system will just die on you. So it's a wedge. It's a pi by 3 wedge of the disk. And once this gets going, you'll start to see a transition point appearing somewhere around here, where you have a thick disk inside, and then you have a thin disk that's starting to interpenetrate a little bit into it. So it's just like that. So you can start to see it developing here. I skip this to the end. Yeah, okay, there you go. So on the face of it has the same character as the previous, I stopped talking, okay. Can I have 30 more seconds? Especially since my clicker won't work. So that's just. Yes, I know. So again, there's a sharp transition here. Interestingly, I didn't flag it before, but before there was actually a tail of cold gas that made it quite deeply into that transition point. Now there's not. The turbulence just mushes all that up. Okay, so it's all gone. Maybe there's a little bit of a cold disk trying to reform in the center. Not quite sure where that's coming from. That could actually be stuff just falling in from the poles and forming a little dense disk in there. But again, you have this nice thermal breeze that is going from the disk. So let's move to my conclusions. Skip that. Oh, this is how alpha varies, by the way. There's a depression of alpha in the hot region. Alpha's depressed where there's a thermal instability going on. Interesting. And let's come to the conclusion. So, shock propagations, I want to highlight the role of the dynamo and for the nonlinear variability, and then structure of disks. I think we're starting to set up a toy system where we can do some interesting investigations of the state transitions. Thank you.
I loved the source of the aperiodic variability. Although in my talk I was stressing what we could calculate without magnetic fields, I think for this turbulence we absolutely require the MRI.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. And you were driving it on the dynamo. What's the dynamo timescale set by? What's the physics of that?
Well, that's a good question. And one thing I skipped over there is that we see in the second simulation I showed, we see the dynamo and where there's that thermal instability going on with quite a short time scale. I mean, four orbital periods. On the other, on the more classic disk, it's a long period. It's 10, 20 orbital periods for the dynamo cycles. I don't know why, but the dynamo is doing some interesting things here. Mm. And as we see, you know, it could actually have connections to important observables. So
there's no kind of physical analysis, no physical intuitive reason you can pull out that gives you that dynamo timescale?
There are other experts here who have worked on it, and I haven't.
They're looking shifty.
They're looking shifty, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, after the fact, you can describe it. You can make a dynamo model with an alpha, a dynamo alpha, not our alpha, but dynamo alpha. But that's after the fact.
So, short answer. There are many more layers to explain the dynamo cycle and why it has a typical period, which is like 50 local orbital timescale. There is no simple argument. I mean, you can use like alpha type of models, what Oliver was describing last week. There is no short answer. That's bottom line. Now, I wanted to ask a question which is related to that. Well, it's directly related. You're saying that you can explain this variability by saying that you have a dynamo timescale which is of the order of the viscous timescale, more or less, because otherwise it doesn't work. Now, the dynamo timescale should scale like the orbital period, whereas the viscous timescale should scale like the orbital period times h over r. So presumably, if you'd move to a thinner disk, then this matching would not work anymore. Is this true? And then, I mean, absolutely. Does it mean that thin disks should not show any viability like that?
And interestingly, what we need to do is close this loop and go back to our toy 1D model and see whether even the dynamo we have in our H over R 0.1 disk, is that slow enough? Because that's also actually faster than the viscous timescale. So it's a good question. You'd have thought that at some point, if the important timescale here is viscous, and it makes complete sense it should be, and if the dynamo is some multiple of dynamical timescale, you're going to separate those too far once you get to thin enough disks. Yeah, you're quite right.
So I have a comment and a question. The comment is that, well, maybe Greg was going to bring this up. I hope I didn't steal your thunder. But Greg and I looked at the effect of net field strength and found that for strong fields, the dynamo is quenched, yeah. Right? And I think Junning has also seen this in his simulations. And so the idea that it could be a state transitions and the change to the high soft state could be related to net flux is interesting, yeah, in that respect. The question is more like, is there a physical intuition for how these fluctuations happen on a dynamical timescale, but the dynamo happens on a longer timescale, and I don't have a good physical picture in my mind how one drives the other. Do you?
No.
Okay.
I have struggled, this is my own failing, I have struggled for a very long time to get even a rudimentary understanding of this dynamo, and so far I've failed.
So, Chris, my question is related to the second part. So, I and a student, Upasana Das, have a paper on, very simple-minded hydro alpha disk simulations where we address exactly the same question, yep. When does a thin disk condense out? And I think the criterion is essentially the viscous time and the cooling time, the classic, argument. And your MHD simulation shows that the truncation radius is farther out.
Mm.
It may be related to the fact that the effective alpha is much higher, so the truncation radius will that be consistent with what you're seeing, or does it sound plausible at least?
So we actually tried to match the alphas between our MHD and a hydro simulation. In fact, the whole point of the hydro simulation was to give us something to compare to the MHD, and for that reason, we tried quite hard to match the alphas. I apologize for not. You're right. You did some very nice work in this, and we were at some level jumping off from you and saying, well, let there be a transition. You did a nice work on why there is one. Let there be a transition and try and study the structure of it in some detail. Interestingly, you come to that sort of S-curve or Z-curve, more like that I had. There's no particular reason why the hydro disk shouldn't have unzipped and kind of gone in the region where it could have a hot flow or a cold flow. It always chose to have a cold flow. It only went hot when it had to. And yet the MHD disk seems to have made a slightly different choice. In the MHD disk, that transition is pushed out a little bit. Not a lot, but it's pushed out a little bit. And I wonder whether the turbulence is driving the disk to a slightly different choice there, where it can actually be much more, it can jump much more easily up to the higher branch.
So I noticed that this idea that it's the dynamo timescale really that drives the nonlinear fluctuations. I think that's really interesting. And I just want to make two points about how this scales with other types of systems. Mm. So first of all, you mentioned Simos Gerenji's paper, of course, or papers, I should say. And of course, he's shown really that exactly the same type of phenomenology is seen in accreting white dwarfs in all different states, black holes in all different states, AGN in all different states.
And some of those disks are really thin.
All kinds of different things. Yeah. YSOs have the same RMS flux relation, have the same power spectra.
Yeah.
So one thing I think that's interesting is then, do they all have the same dynamo, despite the fact that potentially they're driven in totally different ways? I mean, MRI is not necessarily thought to be what's going on in all of them. And then, but on the plus side, the sort of question I had, have you thought about, so in CVs, which I'm most familiar with, we've actually had Simo has discussed at length that the problem that actually in CVs, it just doesn't work if you assume the viscous timescale is the key thing. So the breaks in the power spectra that are typically associated with various viscous timescales just aren't in the right place. So I wondered if you've thought about whether this could fix it. And if so, also, does that mean we could potentially use different systems to constrain what the dynamo timescale actually scales with? from observations.
It's an interesting result. I think we may have talked about it once before about the timescale mismatch in the CVs, and I don't have any particular thoughts on it other than it would be interesting to ask how, or to explore further and deeper, how the dynamo and the thermal physics interact, and whether how the thermal timescale comes into play, which may fit some of the breaks you see rather better.
So as a follow-up, I totally agree with Geoffroy that it's certainly very unclear what really pins down the cycle period. But on more fundamental grounds, I would like to point out that the dynamo pattern we see is a wave pattern. So there's a propagation speed, and that you get from the linear theory. And the easy way to explain this is that the electromotive force in a dynamo is proportional, or has parts that are proportional to the magnetic field. And because a change in the magnetic field is a curl of that EMF, you get a gradient. So wherever this quantity has a gradient, the B field changes, and then you see that this gives you a propagating pattern. And also I would point out that when the cycle disappears, it doesn't necessarily mean that you suppress the dynamo or you kill it. You can push this propagation speed into a long time scale, and then you get a stationary mode, and there are known dynamos that have stationary modes as well.
And can it exist in a non-stationary but non-periodic manner? Can you have sort of long time scale, more chaotic behavior?
I mean, the Earth dynamo, right? Geodynamo, that's very erratic. So it has one polarity, and then it suddenly changes, and then it has another polarity for a long time scale. So in principle, given the regime of the dynamo, you could expect that kind of behavior as well.
Yeah, because I mean, for this variability aspect, for driving the propagation fluctuations, it doesn't really care that the dynamo has a quasi-periodicity to it. I mean, it just wants a driving term with some characteristic and slow enough frequency.
So in your truncated disk, you just changed the cooling function. Did you have any conduction? Because this is one of the ideas for doing the flow transformation, that you have heat conduction from a hot flow to a cooler disk. So did you include conduction?
Good question. No, there's no conduction in this model. So the thermodynamics is the simplest possible that would give you a truncation. And the truncation is sort of forced by fiat in that. Now, you're quite right. The next steps would be to put more realistic thermodynamics in and actually try and, you know, kind of the combination of this and the kind of thing Pratik did, try and let the disk naturally truncate through some more physical processes, and conduction could be essential to that, to evaporate the disk.
Because Jim Pringle had a code that did this, and you could see the disk kind of making this transition, which was, but didn't have enough other physics in.
So in the spirit of Mitch and Phil's model for state transitions that you put up there, have you thought about injecting flux at this interface and seeing if you can accumulate it inward through the thick flow, or looking at flux transport through at that interface?
That would be, I mean, this would be the model system we're building here could be a good one to explore the flux transport issue. Now, the technical details of how you eject flux into these, maybe you have particular ideas of how to do it, but I don't know how to do that.
The dynamo generates it locally.
But whether it gets generated naturally from this, you could examine from these kind of models.
Are there more questions? Yeah, maybe you ask a question and
then we move on. So Omer showed this interesting features of GRS 1915, the various states of it. Are we getting any closer to understanding those?
I don't know. I mean, GRS 1915 is a complete freak show. Maybe some of the simpler stages, you know, the more periodic stages, we could start to think whether some of these thermal limit cycles that we might be seeing would have anything to do with those. Some of the more complex types of behavior, I'm no closer to understanding, I think, than I ever have been.